Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Wait. How do I look? The same as you always look? Shit.
This is The Extra Hot Grape Podcast, episode 340 for the week of February 1st, 2021. I am the death of journalism, David T. Cole, and I'm here with single family hotbox, Sarah D. Bunting.
Howdy, neighbors.
And entitled brat, Tara Ariano.
Who's going to pick me up from school? Welcome to Extra Hot Great. Hello, everybody. Two announcements up at the top before we get into it. First, cannons and Nonax, do you have them? Are they burning a hole in your back pocket? It is time for you to send them in. We are getting low on submissions. So please, if you have any that you've been pondering what we might say about them, now's the time. Please send them in to us. Go to extrahotgreat.com. Click on Info Hub, and there are instructions there that will tell you exactly what you should do and how you should send those in. We were supposed to have a guest with us today. Sadly, LaToya Ferguson is not feeling well. She had to bow out. We are so sad to miss her for a couple of reasons. We will, of course, have her back in the future, but mostly because this was her topic. The reason that we were going to have her on for this is that she was tweeting about it when they finally announced the date for this, our lead topic today, which is Firefly Lane, a new show on Netflix. I had been DMing with her in December about her coming on, and when she expressed excitement about this, I thought, perfect, we're going to have her on, we're going to talk Firefly Lane, and now she's not here, we're going to have to soldier on without her.
That's bullshit.
Yeah, it's going to be weird, but these things happen, so it's going to be a slightly shorter episode without a guest for that reason, because we're going to skip over game time. Here we go, Firefly Lane, without our expert. Let's get into it. Talking about Firefly Lane, a new show based on a book by Kristen Hanna, developed for TV by Maggie Friedman, formerly a writer on Dawson's Creek, and once and again, who also developed Sarah's favorite show, Witches of East End.
Woo!
It's about the decade-spanning friendship between Tully, played as an adult by Katherine Heigl. She is, when we meet her in the present day, which in this is 2003, she's the nationally famous host of a daytime talk show. And her best friend, Kate, played as an adult by Sarah Chalk, used to work with her in local news in the 80s, but left the workforce to get married and have a family, but who is now getting divorced. And as the story jumps around in time from the women's teen years to their early adulthood to now, we get to see the dynamic of their of a relationship where one person is a star and kind of always has been. And one person is generally content to be in her shadow until she isn't. And if you're listening to this podcast the day it dropped, the whole 10-episode first season has also dropped on Netflix today, February 3rd. Chen check-in time. As we finished the first episode, I started singing Dave's favorite new show. It checks all the boxes. So let's start with Dave. Dave, should people watch this show?
First of all, I want to compare it to the book in depth. So when a show like this comes up, usually what I do is I just make a couple cursory comments and then I bow out because obviously it's not my type of show. And who gives a shit what I think about this type of show, right? But then we lost our expert. Yeah, our guest. So now we're like, uh-oh. But like, I just watched the one episode so I can get a taste of it. And then I'm like, I'm done. I know what I
Raisins. Bye.
No, wait, it tastes like raisins.
Not
raisins,
today. If you
raisins
like
are delicious.
So it is Dave's favorite show.
Raisins aren't universal. Like, you shouldn't put raisins in a rice dish. I'll give you that. Mm-hmm. And sultanas are like,
that's the only time I ever like them.
Oh my God. You're on the wrong side of history. Anyway, this
has
been Raisin Talk.
We can't relitigate raisins, guys.
Extra.
Can't we?
Hot Raisin Talk. Anyways,
I hot raisins.
Feel like for this type of show, this was just, even the first episode was full of, crammed full of so many cliches and giant bullseyes of character targets that it felt really lazy and uninspired to me. But then again, I feel like this could be just like lay back and watch it, lazy afternoon type of show that isn't necessarily a bad thing to aim for. Like, I feel like if this was an action film, it would be your middling Van Damme action film. Like, it wouldn't be like the big ones. It would be like, I thought that title was something else, but it's like, it's not Lionheart. It's not Bloodsport. It's like Bloodlion. You're like, oh yeah, this show is definitely Bloodlion. That's what this show is. So anyways, what I'm saying is, if you would watch Bloodlion, and you, then you'd watch this.
91% match according to the Dayflix algorithm.
Yeah, got it.
Sarah.
My longer answer is more complicated than this, but the short answer is no.
Okay. I similarly, I cannot recommend it, but by the same token, I will be watching the whole thing. Like, it really
interesting.
It hooked me in a way that I was really not expecting. So let's drill down a little bit more without Dave.
Wait, but that's what I meant. Like that Jean-Claude Van Damme. I can't even say his name. You know, Lionheart or whatever the hell it is, Lionsport.
Yeah.
Like, it's not a good movie, but I spent the afternoon watching it. Like,
sure.
I recognize that it's not well made and it's not particularly clever. Or
but you can say that with authority
new,
because you watched the whole thing.
But I was there for it.
Yeah.
And that's what I feel like this show is for you.
Yeah. Well, so when a show comes along that's so much for ladies that the trailer feels like if you muted it, it might also be an ad for Summer's Eve. Like, I go into it determined not to let it pander to me. But this series premiere, I feel like it had like just enough prickliness to intrigue me. And Sarah, I feel like this is something you would never even sample if we were not making you. So talk a little bit more about your experience of the pilot.
Well, I talked about this concept in a review of a true crime book the other day, which you can find at bestevidence.fyi. If you would like, if you would not, that is fine. And the idea that you have to meet things where they are when you are giving criticism of them.
Yeah.
And you can't be mad at something for not being something else.
Yeah.
So when I say that you shouldn't watch Firefly Lane, it's not because I was mad that it wasn't like The Sopranos or Bosh or something that I would rather watch. I think even for what it is, it's not good for some of the reasons that Dave said. Like, well, and actually the comparison I made in the book review was like, if I've been asked to judge an oatmeal raisin cookie contest, I can't really be bitter about all the raisins because that's the fucking point of it.
Yeah.
So there were things about this that really were like the Summer's Eve radio narrative hour, like you said.
Totally.
It was like, I don't know.
Yeah.
But it was more like, no, this isn't for me. But if it were a well-made thing that was not for me, I could at least appreciate. Like, I know what a well-made oatmeal raisin cookie looks like. I believe you if you say it's delicious. I'm not going to try it.
Right.
But this just felt extremely labored, dated. Heigl seemed desperately unhappy in every scene in a way that was not the character. I think there's an interesting story in the flashbacks with her mom. But first of all, the timeline didn't seem entirely correct to me. Like, I'm not the mathiest person, but I was like, oh, wait, but it's 1969. Plus, there were just things that like, this isn't how even addicts behave. And this is not how a custodial grandparent behaves. Would behave, and I just was not buying a lot of these things. And the Sarah Chalk character, I mean, she is doing yeoman duty in this part, but everything is just so performatively of its time. And then you get to the end of the first episode and you see where the conflict is and the Bechdel test not only has been failed, but has been like thrown out a window onto a four-lane highway. And it's like, okay, like I don't know how this stacks up in comparison to the book, but as a discrete ETE viewing experience, this is not something that I enjoy because it felt like airless and desperate at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
So it's both, it's an oatmeal raisin cookie that like was left out in the rain also. So that's where I'm at with it, kind of.
Right.
Oatmeal raisin.
But oatmeal rained on? I don't know.
I hear everything you're saying. I guess like my expectation, it's definitely very middle brow source material. It's like in the Jodi Picoult,
sure,
Jennifer Weiner lane. Like, and there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not like besmirching that. I have experienced those books or whatever and those adaptations too. And they're fine as far as they go. Like, I'm not mad at that. But everything you're saying is right, and yet I still was, like, interested to see where the story went. Like, it was just...
This is why I ended up doing research, though, because I was like, can someone please post the entire plot of this so I can find out what happens without having to spend time with Katherine Heigl anymore?
Right. Well, let's jump to her, because this is not the first time that she's returned to TV since her... People often forget... Emmy-winning performance as Izzy in Grey's Anatomy.
Yeah.
She did that NatSec drama State of Affairs that was on for a hot season, and then legal drama Doubt, same. Mm-hmm. And then she was on Suits right at the end of its run. But the nature of this project and its accessibility on Netflix feels much more calculated, I think, to appeal to people that loved her on Grey's. Like, all of those feel like... I'm not trying to get back in that lane. And this is very much like, fine, which may be what you respond to, where it's like, this ought to hold the little SOB's energy that was radiating off her performance. Like,
yeah. And there's definitely that, I don't know. I call it that sort of wine and crime brow. That a line like, think of all the new penises you're about to meet. Like, I think the intended audience for this is like, oh, and I'm like, okay.
Yeah.
I mean, again, I don't think there's anything like insincere or cynical about it. I just feel like, I don't know if it was like protocols during shooting or some parts were not cast as well as they could have been, but I don't know. Like, I just was like, the story is not an interesting, but the execution over 10 hours, like, I can't continue.
Yeah, there definitely were casting problems. Like, chemistry across the board is not there. Like, not even just with the romantic partners, but with the two of them, I guess I mostly buy. But either of them with the guy that they're fighting over that we find out at the end of the pilot why that's still, of course, a source of conflict. And I won't say what the big reveal is because it's obviously supposed to be a big, oh, my goodness. But like, he's such a nothing that it's like him.
Like, yeah, he's like absolutely one of those scruffy Carhartt wearing secretly does needlepoint Hallmark movie Canadians out of, you know, central Manitoba casting that it's like him. I understand he's Australian. Don't at me.
Yeah, he's very much the now I can't remember the actor's name who played Luke on Gilmore Girls. He's the Australian, that guy.
Yes.
With the including the grumpiness for no reason.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, yeah, you have a job. Shut up.
Which I mean, maybe that's so that like, I don't know, the target demographic is not like distracted by how hot he is because the real story is the friendship. But.
Yeah.
That's what good writing and acting by the ladies in the cast is for? ?
Scott Patterson is who I was trying to think of. But yes. Speaking of the ladies. It is, of course, hilarious that Sarah Chalk is cast as, like, the mousy friend, because no one on TV is mousy, but she is also stunning. And since she was recently on Speechless as the polished, perfect mom opposite a supposed mess played by, again, ridiculous, mini driver.
Mm-hmm.
But
yeah.
But I did also spend, because of that role, I spent a little time while I was watching this thinking about what it would be like if they had switched roles. It's like that tweet format where it's like Sarah Chalk could play Tully, but Katherine Heigl could not play Kate. Or maybe she could, like, with a dishwater dye job. I don't know. Perhaps. It's hard to imagine.
Maybe. Heigl just has an energy that I think she's actually probably a better actor than she's given credit for, but mm-hmm. she has a certain casting energy that's like, I think maybe she's just not offered these parts that would let us think she could do it. Like, yeah. I can't imagine it, but I also kind of feel like, you know, maybe this is something that because of the difficult tag,
yeah,
that she's not, that they're like, oh, well, this is a little harder to do, and that's the main character is the mousy one, and we don't want to spend that much time with her. Like, I don't, mm-hmm. whatever.
Right. I am going to keep watching this whole super corny thing, and I will say it's because of a thing that I've bitched about with other shows that I've sampled and ditched, and it's because while there are mysterious teases, because it has a sort of elliptical, you know, it jumps around in time. And there's mm-hmm. in the second episode, it jumps even forward ahead from 2003 to future events. So there okay. is a mysterious thing, but it's not like a crime mystery. And so what I appreciate about it is like, it's letting the human drama be the drama, which is enough. Like, there doesn't have to be a secret, like, you know, we all killed a guy and now this is what all bonds us. Like, every story doesn't have to be that, you know?
So if they had all killed a guy when they were like in the news business, I right. might have kept going with it.
Exactly. We're not
or
the
like
same.
All the actors killed a guy and that's why they had to do this crappy show. Extortion.
Yeah. I mean, I think this is like Netflix is positioning it to appeal to people who liked Dead to Me. And I think Dead to Me fans are going to be frustrated that that's the aspect it's missing. Mm. But that was the part of like when Dead to Me added that was when I was like, I'm out. So,
yeah,
you know, if whichever kind of person you are, whether you're a Tara or a Sarah, like, give it a shot. And
and if you're a Dave,
don't
drive through. We have a listener message from Elspeth Olson. She writes, EHG and AWT, that's again with this, our sister podcast on 90210 and Melrose Place, have helped me feel less lonely and cling to whatever semblance of sanity I can claim. Oh, right back at ya. I want to sponsor a bunting rant on the topic of for choice. I don't especially care when it happens. Well, it's happening now. You also didn't specify, Ms. Olson, what topic I should, like, generally, I actually considered ranting about raisins, but this is a podcast about television. So I'm going to be talking about the Sex and the City reboot and how it needs to not happen. Here is why. I would not call myself a fan of this show, given how infuriating I tended to find it. But for some reason, the first movie is a Poppy Fields Ooh. Movie for me. I've seen it dozens of times. I own it in two different formats. In an immediately post 9/11 world, the girls' relationships with each other and with their city were very comforting, both despite and because of how fantastical the show's version of the city was. Like, Carrie lives and dresses like that on a column a week. No. But that Fantasia element was part of the attraction. I think the whole thing was explicitly about big fairy tale ideas of things, chiefly love. So I didn't have a problem with the fairy tale Manolo wall in her apartment. But the second movie was such a pile of hairy garbage. The absurd subplot with Carrie semi-cheating on Aiden, like 5,000 miles from home. Okay. The obnoxious condescension to Muslim women. The continued smirky treatment of gay men, like amusing purse dogs, which always sucked and drove me crazy. That really, truly should have been the end of it. Particularly if nobody in entertainment was going to have a goddamn bake sale to revive The Carrie Diaries, which was adorable. Just as fun to look at as the original, the characters are much more likable, and it didn't think, quote, diversity meant moving one character to Brooklyn. I'm very sympathetic to the issues facing middle-aged actors who do not particularly want to transition into playing moms or teachers with no pertinent genitalia in their storylines. It's not like nobody's going to watch the shtees, but I guess I don't understand why these people need their own WPA, especially if it's not going to include Kim Cattrall. Do I think Kim Cattrall is my cup of meat for hanging out? No, I sure don't. Is that what the fucking money is for? Yep, it sure is. So either invite everyone in the class or ruminate on the idea that this class, in the other sense of that word, has had its story told endlessly. Since God was in short pants, there's only so much money to go around, and creative, non-ossified projects like, say, High Maintenance and Drunk History have ended, but we gotta watch these three Karens raising teenagers and trying to podcast. For the love of baby vegetables, find a loophole that means you can't shoot it and kill it and give the money to a different creative team. I am not a crackpot. Here endeth the rant. Whew.
I don't know if it's going to show up on the podcast, but I enjoyed Bear in the background agreeing with you.
I apologize. Usually, no. He can always tell when it's like my turn to talk and I can't just like mute myself. And he's like, hey,
I think it's just mail. Adding to your energy, actually.
It was.
I thought that was complimentary.
Was picking up.
I
on
mean,
it.
Look, he and I have discussed this extensively and he agrees. It's rude. He is part of a foursome of pets. You don't break up the team. That's it.
Well said. Tara.
So this week, there wasn't really a noteworthy lowbrow premiere, so instead I'm just doing two shows, one new one, one old one, and the old one is so old that it's a Quibi. So since we'll be talking about AP Bio later in the podcast, spoiler, I was reminded of another important Paula Pell project, Mapleworth Murders, that we had not been able to see, and I wondered if I could fly to the past and find it, and I did. And the good thing about Quibi is that even though it came to us in 12 files, watching all of them back-to-back took as long as watching four episodes of a sitcom, because that's what they should have been all along. So Pell co-created the show with John Lutz, who people may remember from 30 Rock, where he played Lutz. He is also in this as the marginally less dumb local cop. J.B. Smoove plays the chief, who is the more useless of the two. And Pell plays Abigail Mapleworth. She is a prolific writer of mystery novellas who's supposed to be writing her first full-length novel, but she keeps getting interrupted by people around her getting murdered. Or as she says it, mardard. So in the first episode, her Australian niece, Heidi, played by Haley Magnus, who is maybe at college or maybe just pretending to be and actually fucking around, unclear, comes to stay with her. So she helps Abigail with clues that show up in the selfies that she is always taking. So I think my favorite episode is the second one, in which the murder takes place at a launch party at a local winery, where the celebrity author who has put her name on the wine, she's played by Nicole Byer, gets killed by a wine barrel, which rolls towards her very slowly, like definitely slowly enough for her to just step out of its path instead of just standing there screaming at it, and then squishes her flat like a Zamboni in a cartoon. And another character gets killed later using implements, but winery implements. I will not spoil it. So in every story, and I say story because they're each spread over three quibbies, almost like three acts of a sitcom, where the break between episodes is just where commercials would go, Abigail ends up almost getting killed herself and then has to ask herself how she would write herself out of the situation. So we see her fantasy version, in which she is usually dressed in something very glamorous and sequined, and it all goes off without a hitch, and then cut back to reality where it doesn't quite go so well, which is a good gag. And the excerpts from her imagined books also feature her euphemisms for her gay adventures with various exciting ladies. And like AP Bio, the show is produced by Mike Shoemaker and Seth Meyers Production Company. So between the two of them and Pell and Lutz, they get really great guest stars. Chris Parnell, Tim Meadows, Ike Barinholtz, Sarah. He plays a cork supplier in the Wind episode.
Perfect.
Mary Holland, Drew Tarver, Tina Fey, Jack McBrayer, Andy Samberg, Maya Rudolph, Darcy Carden. It's really dumb. If Angie Tribeca could get three seasons, there's no reason this couldn't be salvaged and revived as a regular sitcom on a regular network.
Which is what it is.
Yeah. At the moment, the only way you can see it is if you know, wink, how, wink, to locate such things in places. But Roku bought the Quibi archive, so if you have Roku, it's probably coming there soon. I checked, just watch. It's not there yet. So my second thing is Jan. Sure, Jan. Jan Arden is a Canadian singer-songwriter. Her big hit in the 90s was Insensitive. You may recall that one. Got to number 12 in America. She's a huge deal there. She's won a ton of Junos, Canada's Grammy. She's in the Canadian Music Hall of Fame. She's written books. She has a podcast, yada, yada. In recent years, she has gotten into acting. And in 2019, she co-created a sitcom for CTV, which is a Canadian TV network, called Jan. There have been two seasons so far. They both came to Hulu last week. So it's kind of like Curb Your Enthusiasm in that she plays a comic version of herself. But all of her family members and her manager and whoever else are all actors. But it's also like the comeback, because the premise of the show is that it's like the fictionalized Jan is not doing so well career-wise. So Feist's manager, whose name is Kale, offers to manage her and revive her career. So this one was frustrating because it's so close to being good. It had little touches that made it feel real and grounded. There's a whole sequence where Jan is at home. She's like just sitting on the couch tweezing her chin hairs. And then her sister butt dials her and Jan hears something about cupcakes. So she's like just hangs up and goes over there. And then she just starts eating snacks out of the kids' lunches, which is like cute, real. Or when she demands that her manager book her on a big benefit, and then he calls later and goes, "You got cancer." And she's like, "Yeah." And then he goes, "Fest." Like, she already understood, but it's still funny.
Yeah, you have to.
So, but it feels like they don't totally have a handle on the tone. So it really just yaws from grounded to cartoony in a way that is hard to engage with. And the climax of the first episode is Jan running off the road and hitting a barn, and then she runs from cops who are trying to help her, and they're like, "We're trying to help you," and she's like, "I watch CNN," which is like, ooh, bad tone deaf joke, like, you're a white lady. But then she tries to crawl under a barbed wire fence, and she gets what we're supposed to think is her labia snagged on a barb. But she's wearing leggings, and they're stretched out so far. Like, if any part of you is actually in there, like, something is very, very wrong.
Like, bigger problems than barbed wire.
Exactly. Yeah. At the very least, you should be wearing special underwear. But anyway, also, Kale keeps telling her what to do and is always right. But Jan keeps fighting her and then giving in. So it's like, do you want this comeback or do you not? Like, all of that, again, frustrating on a premise level. But on top of all of that, it is so Canadian. Like, I am Canadian. There were Canadian jokes I didn't get because I haven't lived there for so long. And cameos of pop stars who were like, "I don't know who that is.
Where's my glass tiger?"
I've never heard of exactly. So I feel like that's going to be off-putting to Americans who are already only, like, dimly aware of who Jan herself is to begin with. So anyway, so for my plug, I reviewed her for Primetime and got into a lot of this. But in addition to that, for my other plug, I mentioned it the past couple of weeks, listen to Sassy, our podcast where we go through every issue of Sassy magazine, is now out. Our first proper episode is now up, where we talk about teen life in the March 1988 issue. And you can find it at listentosassy.com. Also on all of your podcast platforms, and you can follow the podcast at Listen to Sassy on Instagram or Twitter.
Sarah D. Bunting.
Yeah, slight tone change here. I'm here to talk about the 6-part Danish true crime show that just hit HBO Max as we're recording this yesterday, so Monday of this week. It's called The Investigation. It stars many of the same people who were in Borgen. So I finally started watching Borgen. Yay! But I'll get back to that. I wrote about The Investigation for Primetimer, and my headline, like, they always change my headlines because I'm terrible at them, or they think I am, which is fine. But the headline on this was like, much more sort of unalloyed positivity about it. Here's the thing about The Investigation.
Wait, is like, this still the headline? Because if so, I can see why they changed it.
always thinking, Dave Cole. The Investigation never shows the suspect,
never mentions the suspect's name. Like, this is based on a real case, the case of Kim Vall, the journalist who went into the inventor's submarine and did not return. That was 2017 that happened. So the outcome of all of this is known. But the show never mentions him. So, like, there's all these sort of cop show cliches, and also infuriating, like, centering of the killer stuff that it just is not doing. It'll be like, well, the accused says this, but, like, you don't have that shot of the killer sitting smugly in the box and then a focus pull to the cop taking it personally, who's, like, superimposed above him in the two-way glass. Like, there's none of that. However, I don't understand why the show then loses its nerve and does have a large taking it personally plot about the main cop's estranged daughter and how he's never there for her and she's about to have his first grandchild and she needs to, you know, be able to rely on him. And then, of course, like, they're supposed to have a detente coffee and there's a big break in the case and he can't go. Like, maybe my rant should have been about this. This is absolutely my least favorite trope of cop shows. At least now that I'm thinking about it. And then it also has this runner where, like, a big part of the case is that they're searching in like a sound, like the sea between Denmark and Sweden for evidence. And the head of the Royal Navy's investigations team has at least one dozen scenes in which he's like, we need different parameters. This is too hard to find the stuff. Like, either have this dude quit or cut the scenes. Like, we get it. It's the sea. It's deep. Things float away. There's currents. But I mean, it's just not, it starts to be funny after a while, but not, you know, like you like. With all of that said, like, even with this stuff going on and, like, you see the, you know, the daughter's front door and you're like, oh, Christ, it doesn't feel like the pacing is still really good. You're still sucked into it. Like, even it's, you know, subtitled. And unless you speak Danish, you're going to need them. It felt really well-paced and gripping, even though a lot of it is focused on the investigation. And a lot of investigations are just grinding, picking, like, busy work, waiting for something to happen to, like, give you that great leap forward. The acting's really good. The writer-director, Tobias Lindholm, has directed Mads Mikkelsen, who played Hannibal in a lot of stuff, and directed a couple episodes of Mindhunter, which is sort of funny that those properties are about analyzing the, you know, the mind of the killer, and then he tacks completely in the other direction with this. The taking it personally stuff is a little disappointing, but I definitely recommend this. It's very good. And a lot of the same people, including, I can't remember the actor's name ever because he looks so much like Josh Jackson that I just call him Danish Pacey.
Yeah, yeah.
Danish Pacey is in both of them. Saren Malling is in both of them. He's the lead in the investigation, and he's excellent in this. Yeah. So, and Borgen is really good so far also. Like, so much happens in the first hour. Oh, yeah. And then I just kept popping them. It's like, oh, if House of Cards were, you know, good and credible and gave its audience some credit. Neat.
If you don't know Danish Pacey from Borgen, you may know Danish Pacey from Game of Thrones. So if there's a guy in Game of Thrones, you're like, he looks like Dawson's friend. That's him.
Yeah. And Lindholm also was involved in the original The Killing, and a couple of these dudes were in that too. And yeah, it's good. My review of it is at Primetimer with a nice, trim, cheery title. There are actually a couple things wrong with it, but it's good.
Just follow up on Danish Pacey. He stars as who I absolutely do call Ship Guy. In Game of Thrones. He's the guy who has ships.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now you know who I'm talking about for sure.
Ship guy.
All right. I have two things. The first one, it was sort of like a tiny triumph, but not really. But you may remember when we were talking about WandaVision, I was going off about my idea for sort of a Wakanda show that tackles the political fallout from a supposed death of the king. looks like they actually are making a show that is being described as a Wakanda show. So I'm hopeful that maybe that idea actually is happening.
I saw a few places posit like a West Wing and Wakanda idea. Yeah. So that seems to be in the water. And it's also from Ryan Coogler, who directed Black Panther. So, which is great.
So I'm hopeful. So maybe that'll actually happen. That would be very
cool. That would
cool
be rad.
Show. Yeah. The show, new show that we watched this week is the sci-fi show Resident Alien.
Yes.
It is about a alien who comes to Earth and, you know, his car falls apart and then, you know, a space car. And he's stuck here and sort of a fish out of water kind of dramedy.
Yeah.
Kind of, though the mix is a little weird to me.
It is,
but the headline is it stars Alan Tudyk.
It does.
And this show would be a big zero nothing without him. So really, like, the takeaway is that Resident Alien is a exhibit A on why Alan Tudyk is sort of a nerd treasure. You know, like he's
so good.
He saves the show.
Yeah. There are a lot of points where it was like a line would be super corny, and then he's, because of his delivery, he makes it work as a funny joke. Like he's incredible. He's great.
He kills some dude who, and then he becomes, you know, the alien becomes this guy, and then he's called into town, which he's trying to avoid because he's not quite sure he's acting human enough yet. Mm-hmm. And so it's sort of like a fish out of water story. It's kind of like a lot of alien stories, like people of Earth and stuff like that in the past, except like this guy's out to destroy the world. Will he in the end? Probably not, right? Because that's his journey. But it was pretty funny, although like the drama elements, they don't do a great job jamming them up. Like there's a spousal abuse storyline that feels very at odds with other things that are happening in the episode. Mm-hmm. Like they're trying to go for like, it's Pleasantville, but there's like this weird undercurrent of darkness in this town.
Yeah.
And they don't marry the two very well.
No.
And it really, like that part of it really shows its comic book roots, which is apparently where it's from. It's a comic book. That oscillation, that whiplash, didn't really work here.
Yeah, I agree with that.
So I feel like if they could like tune that to do something a little lighter or like smooth out the transitions or something between them, like there's something missing there. But Alan Tudyk is what you're going to come to this for. Does it have legs? I don't know. Like, is it going to be the same thing episode after episode? But surely the first episode is worth a watch. I laughed a few times and it's fun to watch. I'm like, also like Doom Patrol. He was like great in Doom Patrol too. Like he's just like,
even just as a narrator
and
an off-screen presence, he's very good.
Absolutely.
Sarah, there's a sequence where he's because he's got like 4 months after he crashes and assumes this guy's body, basically, where he's just in his cabin and no one knows he's there, where he learns TV by watching Law and Order, and so he just like watches a scene with Jerry Orbach and just repeats his lines over and over again, and we see the progression as he gets better and better. It's very cute.
I've got ties older than him.
And I will say the show uses the canonical chung chung to describe the noise.
He does it.
Nice.
Bonus points for that. It is
I'm
not
sold.
It is nothing else. It is not clang clang or whatever.
No.
It is chung
dong,
chung. If you
dong.
Do anything different,
what is wrong with people?
You're on the wrong side of history. Okay, coming up on the next extra hot great, it is spreading around the holiday cheer. We're looking at other slightly less popular holidays that would make for good TV show episodes or TV show traditions in sort of that Bob's Burgers kind of way. Mm-hmm. And then the next EHG Prime, we welcome back Adam Sternberg to talk about the CBS remake of The Equalizer. So we've had the TV show, then the movie, and now we're back to the TV show. This is with Queen Latifah, correct?
With Queen Latifah as Robin McCall.
Ooh,
not Robert.
Switch it up!
Yes!
It is time for the canon. Presenting this week is Tara Ariano. Take it away, Tara Ariano.
Well, I already teased it when I mentioned Mapleworth Murders. It's AP Bio. We covered this as a lead topic back when it premiered in 2018, but other than Dave and me periodically begging listeners to figure out what Peacock is and please, for the love of God, watch it so that it would get renewed, which apparently worked. So you're welcome, the culture.
Got renewed on Peacock.
Yeah.
Exited NBC, lives on Peacock.
No, but it got renewed for season 4.
Oh, I see what you mean. Got it.
So we have not revisited it properly on the podcast until now, which means we are way overdue. And before season 3 premiered last year, when Dave and I did a rewatch of the first 2 seasons, I had it in the back of my mind to keep an eye out for the first episode that I thought could possibly be a canon contender. And I was surprised it came so early. Today, we're going to be talking about season one, episode two, titled Teacher Jail. So first, a refresher on the premise of AP Bio, for those who don't remember our three-year-old podcast on it. Jack Griffin, played by Glenn Howerton, was a philosophy professor at Harvard before he lost a promotion to his biggest rival, Miles Leonard, played by Tom Bennett, and threw a public fit about it. Bounced out of academia due to the scandal, Jack is forced to return to his hometown of Toledo, live in his late mother's house, and take a job teaching high school biology, kind of. He's actually just in it for the paycheck and makes it clear to his grade-grubbing students that he has no intention of teaching them anything, preferring to spend class time developing broke plans to improve his current lot, which, when we meet him in this episode, generally revolve around destroying Miles' life and usurping his position. Here's what I think makes this episode canon-worthy. Number one. The students versus Jack plot is solid. As we open, Whitlock High School principal Ralph Durbin, Patton Oswalt, is impatiently waiting with Jack's students in his classroom. Jack is unapologetic and unconcerned when he rolls in late, so Durbin has to explain that this is actually a big deal. For safety reasons, the students can't be left alone. This would be news to some of my high school teachers who routinely left us to do group work while they went to the staff room to drink.
Yep.
Obviously, Jack has no intention of altering his behavior. Durbin catches him trying to leave again moments after he arrives. In fairness, he does need sun chips, and obviously the students know it. So you'd think they'd be very careful when Jack takes off again as soon as Durbin's out of sight. And yet, clip one.
How did this happen?
He fell. We were playing Jellybean Quidditch.
Yeah, so you stand on your desks and throw jellybeans in each other's mouths.
How is that Quidditch? Where's the golden snitch?
So nerdy. Victor, you okay, buddy? You want to hop up there?
Yo, this all happened because Mr. Griffin left us unattended. He can't do that. School policy.
Yes, Sarika, thank you for taking what I said earlier and shouting it at me.
Guess what, you guys? It wasn't an accident. It's not entirely clear who came up with the scheme, but the idea is that once Jack is out of the picture getting disciplined, the class will be assigned a substitute teacher who will actually teach them stuff. Before that can happen, though, Durbin's freaking out about having to hold his best friend accountable for violating school rules. Jack is straining to care, and then Durbin's assistant, Helen, Paula Pell, reminds him that there are procedures in place for Jack's protection. Clip two.
I happen to care about this school. But yeah, you don't respect that. And frankly, I don't think you respect me.
Oh, come on, Ralph. You know we cool.
No, I don't know that. Are we cool?
I'm going to take Victor back to class. He's still a bit slow, but I think that was already there.
Yeah.
Wait, who's with the kids right now?
Oh, God, we left him alone again.
That's hilarious.
Jack, please. Helen, go cover for me.
I also called the teachers union, and the rep is here to see Jack.
Which one? Wait, not Kim. Not Kim. Oh, God, please, not Kim. Not Kim, please, not Kim. Hey, Kim!
Number two, Kim! Kim is played by the wonderful Niecy Nash and immediately takes control in a way that lets us know why Durbin finds her so intimidating. Clip three.
Jack, don't say another word. Ralph, get out.
The room is yours.
Tums?
No, good.
I'm freaking addicted. My name is Kim Burke, and as your union rep, I am always on the side of the teacher. I don't care if you did kill that kid. I don't want to know. As I see it, you have two options, or as I like to call them, doors. Huh? Door number one, admit you're at fault, take a one-week unpaid suspension. However, this could go on your permanent record, so. Then there's door or option two. We fight it. You should know. This could take a while because there will be an investigation. Right, and while all that's going on, you won't be allowed back in that classroom.
Say more about that.
You'd be in something called teacher jail, which is basically a trailer where you sit around all day, but that could take a couple months.
It's a long time to not get paid.
Oh, who said that? You would get paid. Full salary.
You know what? It feels wrong sweeping this under the rug. I'd be willing to stay in that damn jail for as long as it takes to make this right.
Truly, when you put it this way, who would say no to teacher jail? Sure, someone who cared about their career as an educator and didn't want a serious disciplinary charge on their record. But other than that, there are some who might say that for Kim to be shown using Jack as a cudgel against Durbin to avenge an injustice from when they were both in high school together is to portray union reps in a bad light. But we have no reason to think Kim is any less zealous in her defense of teachers at schools where Durbin isn't the principal. And we all deserve someone to advocate this passionately for us in the workplace. Bosses beware of Kim. Number three, Helen. The students' scheme to replace Jack with a teacher they think is more worthy of them does not, at first, work out the way they had hoped. Clip four.
Been through so much. That's why Principal Durbin has entrusted me with the sacred duty to, as he would say, just take care of it, Helen. So I went on my computer and I searched for every available sub in the district. And I think I found someone that you're really going to love. Come on in. Don't be shy. Come on. Ta-da, it's me. I think I'd leave you guys with a stranger. I'm going to teach you what I know, starting with the gorgeous velveteen labyrinth that is the female reproductive system. This is my cervix. Who can tell me the five things that are wrong with
it? Oh, my God, Pell.
AP Bio's cult status means that both Pell and series creator Mike O'Brien are not getting the credit they should for the character of Helen, a sweet soul who loves her jobs, her kids, the students, and her boss with an intensity as misguided as it is wholesome. It's actually impossible for me to imagine the kind of churl it would take not to love her, even when she's doing stuff like asking one of her students to point out where on her body various parts are. Clip five.
Oh, Anthony. Perineum. Keep going. Keep going. Keep going. Mine's lower than usual. Keep going.
Dying.
Number four. The portrayal of Teacher Jail is exactly as dark as it should be. I would imagine that in real life, Teacher Jail is not a good time. But gritty realism is not what we come to a sitcom for. If David Simon wants to make a drama about it, that's his right, and I would probably watch it. But on AP Bio, the Teacher Jail trailer is a room that looks no better or worse than any school staff room I've ever seen. And the only rule is that you have to sign in. Pretty chill. Jack's latest notion of how he's going to take down Miles is to write a best-selling book, like Miles has. Jack will have so much time to do it in TJ. Of course, even on a sitcom, we know that most of the teachers who end up jailed, as it were, probably didn't just leave their classrooms unattended. And when Jack enters and comments that he can guess what his fellow inmates probably did, so can we, particularly once we see that Philip is played by Mark Proksch, more recently known as Colin Robinson of the What We Do in the Shadows TV series. And yet, when he recounts his story, it's not too harrowing. Clip six.
You ready for this? I tickled some of the other teachers.
No. Why?
What can I say? I'm a tickler. I love to make people laugh, but I don't know any jokes. It only takes one person, though, to call you a teacher tickler. True or not, you're ruined. You are ruined.
But it was true.
Very much. Yeah.
Teacher Jail is a place where Jack finds a sympathetic ear, a Boswell for his future bestseller, and homemade shortbread. I have found myself in much worse places. Number five, Jack's face turn is exactly as touching as it should be. The time comes for Kim to represent Jack at the preliminary hearing before the board, where, knowing quite well he's not actually in this to clear his name, but to malinger in teacher jail, she unveils her defense strategy. Jack is a superlative educator who could not succeed under Durbin's leadership, and Kim has a PowerPoint presentation full of receipts. Clip seven.
Why aren't the teachers following the school policy? Well, maybe it's because the principal is asleep on the job.
Okay, I'm clearly blinking.
Is he focused on work? Well, not according to his Google search.
Okay, that's private.
I'll allow it.
Kokomo, is it real? Do we really want a principal who's daydreaming about some fake paradise in the Florida Keys?
Well, why are the other ones real? Aruba, Jamaica.
Principal Durbin mowing the school lawn wearing what is known as a wife beater.
It was a Saturday.
Oh! It's okay, everybody, to beat your wife on a Saturday.
Jack mostly doesn't care about people who aren't himself, but he doesn't actually want his own selfishness to cost Durbin his job, so he abandons the grift. Clip 8.
I have something to say, okay? Kim, tickled me.
What? I'm sorry?
She's a teacher tickler. Yeah, she would wait until we were all alone, and then she would just go bananas all over me, tickling me up and down. So, take her away.
What are you talking about? Jack, tickling is not a punishable offense. I'd call it lightly frowned upon or awkward if people are watching.
What, so no one cares that she tickled me? Well, then why is Philip the frickin' best guy I know in teacher jail right now?
That guy did more than just tickle.
Huh, what else did he do?
Oh, well, he dated.
Yes.
He dated the CPR dummy.
Jack confesses and gets docked 3 days' pay. He's hoping for a grace period before he has to return to the classroom, but he's disappointed, though probably not as much as his students are about to be. Clip 9.
My name is Mr. Vining. I am your new teacher, and I love biology. Pretty soon, you're going to love it as well, but not just love it. You're going to understand it. So let's not waste another moment. Our story begins 3.8 billion years ago in a humble puddle of amino acid. You may want to write that down.
All right, Chief, I appreciate it, but I got it from here.
Oh, okay. Well, fair enough.
Yep. All right.
Wait.
Jack tells the kids he knows they staged the accident, but of course it hasn't shaken up his worldview or anything. He's going to remain the same lazy dick who's been depriving them of an education this whole semester, but he does respect them all a little bit more than he used to. Number 6. Seemingly random gags aren't so random. Earlier in the episode, Michelle, Jean Villebeek, tells Kim how assiduously she adheres to the rule about leaving students unattended. Clip 10.
Other people may leave their class sometimes. Not me. Not even if I have to use the bathroom. I just control it.
She's so dedicated.
She's amazing.
She's a queen.
She has pooped her pants a couple of times.
Say what?
I have, but I just borrowed some red track pants from Lost and Found. I wash them and put them back.
Nobody wants those now.
Let the lost be lost.
And when Sarika, Aparna Brielle, is illicitly searching Subfinder for a replacement for Helen, a saxophone-wielding Colin, Tucker Albrizzi, announces that if he sees someone coming, he'll play Baker Street. Cut to the coda of the episode when we see Michelle bravely striding out of the bathroom in red sweatpants as Colin, for no reason, stands in the hallway wailing. Clip 11. It's a delightful moment of absurdity, but not a non sequitur in that it fleshes out both these characters. There's an amazing amount of world building in AP Bio, and it starts very early. Number 7, and finally, minimal Miles content. Jack's vendetta against Miles seems like a story thread that the series may have been sold on, but which, over the first season, feels increasingly tacked on as it becomes clear that what makes the show work is the interaction between Jack and the students and teachers at Whitlock. Miles is, I believe, never mentioned again after season 1, and rightly so. Teacher Jail only briefly mentions him before moving on and is one of the season's stronger episodes for it. To be clear, this is not remotely the only episode of AP Bio that I would consider submitting to the canon, and whether or not this one gets in, you will be hearing from me on it again. What makes this one canon-worthy, in addition to the reasons outlined above, is how very assured it is so early in its run. Where so many shows' second episodes just reiterate what happened in the pilot, Teacher Jail assumes the viewer gets what's going on and starts widening its scope. I hope you will induct it into the canon. And if you don't, I hope you have a plan for defending your vote to Niecy Nash.
Well, when you put it like that. So I guess I'm going first, even though I do need Sun Chips now.
I was going to, like, Sun Chips. Okay, Sun Chips. Let's talk about Sun Chips just for a second.
Yeah, I mean, we could talk about Sun Chips for a very long time.
Okay.
I love them.
Here's my relationship with Sun Chips. When I'm in this grocery store and I'm walking down the chip aisle, I look at Sun Chips and the back of my brain is like, yeah, I like Sun Chips. But then, like, I go to find, like, something I think I'm going to like more, something a little more like the equivalent of your mom wants to get you Chex Mix, but you want Captain Crunch, right? Like, that's a relationship between Sun Chips and, say, salt and vinegar kettle chips or Cheetos or something like that. But when I get home and I think about Sun Chips, I'm like, oh, man, I really want some Sun Chips right now. They're perfect. They're wavy. they carry
Flavor dust.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Anyway, Sun Chips, it sneaks up on you. And I think this is the weekend, next weekend, when we do our weekend shopping. This is the weekend I definitely put Sun Chips in the basket.
You know, it's funny, too. I remember being like, oh, he's a Harvest Cheddar guy. Interesting.
Yeah, French onion is the way to go, in my opinion.
Yeah, I agree. Or you can get both and mix them.
Crazy.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
All right. Well, anyway, Sun Chips, canon worthy or not?
I mean, they're in my snack canon. Excuse me. I need to text my husband and tell him to go get some Sun Chips. I always have a list of, like, the funny lines that made me laugh. And during a canon presentation, if they're covered, I check them off. Almost everything is checked off except the concussion test. Like, Paula Pell, oh my God, what a treasure. And she's used perfectly. Like, the whole episode is really a masterclass in, like, how to push a joke exactly far enough and then stop. And then, like, 11 minutes later, I mean, that, like, red pants thing, I was like, I just had to pause it and sort of lean back in my chair and be like, that's a good bit of business. And she's just sashaying down the hall, holding a garbage bag with her poopy first pair of pants. Like, perfect. And then there's Colin, like, burr, and he's like that little redheaded kid. I mean, it's so great. Like, the whole portrayal of Helen, another place to pause, in my opinion, would be to admire her just crazy cuckoo pants reproductive diagram on the board. Like, there's like thought bubbles. Things are not, like, they don't belong. Like, the egg is an X and then the sperm is an O. Like, what are you doing? And then she finds them on Subfinder and she's like, what the heck are you guys doing on my Dell? Like, it's just little stuff like that, but she's like, not so, like, she's not so crackers that you don't relate to her, but the fact that they're like, go to him, Helen, and she's like, okay, and like zooms off. You're like, that's everything I need to know about this character.
The moment for me that's like that is when she first comes into the class and she says, hey, you gotta do substitute, and then she opens the door, said, don't be shy, come in. And she comes back, ta-da, it's me. Yeah, it's like a great character moment and so goofy.
And then the show doesn't, like, wait around for her to be like bummed out or not by their reaction. It just keeps moving.
Yeah.
Just little teeny things like that, like that it's Sun Chips, that it's the CPR dummy, and that Patton Oswalt, often not my favorite, but he's so good on the show.
Yes.
He's like, he dated the CPR dummy, like, just flawless. And the coach, when he has to sign in, the coach calls him Kemosabe, which is like the coachiest fucking thing. Hey, Kemosabes, front and center. And then they make the horn gesture. I mean, and then, like, Niecy Nash is absolutely perfect to come in like the second episode and be like, okay, we're going to focus all of this energy on someone who is extremely charismatic and knows what to do with this timing.
Yeah.
She does, because she's the best.
Yep.
Yeah, this was so much fun. I remember liking this episode when we first watched the show, but I have not gone back to AP Bio, probably because, you know, see previous comments, Ray, mile long list.
Sure.
But it is on the list, and it's moving up. Excellent presentation, and you were not flatting. Good day. Dave.
I think the best compliment to pay to this episode and why it's probably canon worthy is it really feels like a second or third season episode.
It really,
yeah, it really does.
Yep.
That it strays from just being set in the classroom alone because it's like the second episode of the series.
Yep.
But also it expands this universe right away.
Yep.
And it's not hand-holding you. All these things you yep. usually associate with the series later run where they're more assured. They know they got renewed. You know, the ratings are okay and all that kind of stuff. And it gets a bit goofy. And then AP Bio is weird that, like, the season after they had their close call, not cancellation, is, like, their craziest, most bonkers season. Season three is the first.
So weird.
The first Peacock
yeah.
season is so weird and out there. It yeah. is great.
It's wonderful.
I think I've said it in a podcast before, but Matt Belknap from Never Not Funny described it as a fever dream
yes.
of a mm-hmm. season. And yes. he's, like, totally right. Perfect mm-hmm. way to describe it. And you can see, like, the genesis of that trajectory.
Yes.
Even on episode two. So I think it speaks to how confident they were in what they had built for the TV show. Mm-hmm. But just like the start of like sort of the 1,000 years stare, Killing Fields possum speech at the start where he's describing his day that began with like this bloodbath of possum stuff in his driveway. It's just like such a weird tone and just kind of loved it. It's to me, so I feel screaming. Like... I talked about how Superstore, what I like about it is I think it introduced a lot of people to mean-spirited comedy in a way that was clever and sneaky. Mm-hmm. And I feel like if you reacted to those parts of Superstore, then I think you should check out AP Bio because I think they share a lot of the same sensibilities when yeah. it comes to that balance. Just a couple random things. I thought it was weird that the scripts calls them Tums, but the prop is antacid generic. You know, yeah. Hensler beer style
yeah.
prop. It's just weird. I mean, why?
She's a teacher. She can't afford name brand Tums.
Yeah, that's true.
But you would still call them Tums.
That's a good point. That's a good point.
Yeah. There's a name for that. It's like a brand term creep or something like that.
Like Kleenex.
Yeah. yeah.
No one calls it facial tissue. But
Right. And I just want to give a shout out to the color grading of this series, something I really enjoy. And I think what they've done is it's sort of like it's teal shadows and sort of a creamsicle highlights. Yeah. And it creates this sort of Norman Rockwell-y 50s nuclear America kind of color palette where it's a little retro, but then it's played up by the set decorations, like the school yep. colors are blue and gold.
Yep.
The principal's office has got blue blinds and his couch is blue. So like the teal really pops and everything. If you're watching the show and you're like, why does everybody have like really blue eyes? Well, it's because of the color grading.
Yep.
But it's something that's very unique to this show, but it works because it's like this weird kind of out of time school, you know, and,
yeah.
and it works really well.
Well, it's obviously very intentional. Like even the costuming carries it through too. Like any frame looks like that. It's that orange and blue. Yeah, I love it.
Yeah, it's really smart.
It looks like my high school too because it was built in the 60s and that was the color yeah. of that time.
Yeah, brutalist fluorescent lighting. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So, yeah, great episode, very assured, very funny. And if you haven't sought out AP Bio, now's your chance. It's on Peacock. Highly recommended. So let's put this to the two-person vote. Sarah D. Bunting.
Oh, my God. Yes, Sun Chips.
Yes, you're for in. Me, for Sun Chips. All right, AP Bio, Season 1, Episode 2, Sun Chips, otherwise known as Teacher Jail. You're hereby inducted into the Extra Hot Great Canon.
Americans love a winner.
Yup.
And will not tolerate a loser.
Nope.
Kind of thought you might use the Baker Street music for my triumph music.
lost opportunity.
I was just going to suggest we should do loser first and then winner so we don't end on something really dark since we don't yeah. have game time
okay,
last.
Okay, let's do that.
It's time for a loser and winner of the week. Who has our loser?
I do. It's Wipeout, which here's how we put it in the doc, which has killed another contestant. Here's the thing. Once you read the background on this, like poor Wipeout, like they're still losers, but what a hard luck slot this time. The dude was 38.
Yeah.
He'd been through the checks. I mean, especially Wipeout is not going to be fucking around with letting, you know, the unfit Mm-mm. run the course. But he got knocked into the water. He had trouble getting to the edge. They sent him to the hospital. He lost consciousness, like in a wheelchair next to the course. Mm.
He passed away the next day. It was an undiagnosed cardiac something. And again, 38. God. Like, I mean, poor wipeout. But yeah, yikes. Maybe guys don't go on that show.
Yeah. Maybe.
Wow.
We send our condolences to his family. Yikes. Yeah. That's rough. Kokomo, like, maybe this one is just too hard. Like,
yeah.
Anyway.
Look, much you're like going to appreciate Hart. My gallows humor, or you can get out of town. All right, who's our winner?
Well, speaking of game shows where you could really hurt yourself, our winner is Whack-A-Mole, because they're giving it the holy moly treatment. They're going to do a Whack-A-Mole TV show. Fremantle Media is making it. They're going to do like a big, you know, life-size Whack-A-Mole, some kind of obstacle course situation. No network is attached yet. Mm. How is this going to work? Unclear. Who's doing the whacking? Don't know.
Quote Amy from Superstore. Really? Hitting animals still? 2020?
Yeah. I don't know. But yes, it's apparently going to happen. Again, this is our new post-peak TV reality, which is, by the way, official. 2020 was the first year where there were fewer scripted shows than the year before. Sure. So it's, you know.
I mean, if they pair this with a skee ball thing, I'm in.
Well, here's something, some news in this article that was relevant to Dave T. Cole. This is the second Mattel property in development for a game show. Apparently, Mattel owns Whack-A-Mole. I didn't know this was possible for someone to own, but they do.
I didn't either.
I guess the other ones are like Critter Crunch and...
I guess. Right, But the first one, Dave, Uno.
Oh.
The sweariest game show that ever there was, based on Dave's experience of playing it online.
It's just one of those games that tears families apart, right? Because it's really a backstabby game, and people take it way more personally than they, like, honestly should. But then you're like, yeah, no, fuck you, Dad. Yeah. You're like, yeah.
That draw four card, like, when it comes out.
Okay, but here's the thing.
People get punched, and they should.
Yeah, it's true.
Mattel, Uno Incorporated, the governing body that controls Uno International, has come out and said that accumulative penalty cards are against the rules, and that's not the way you play Uno.
No.
Or somebody slaps down a +4, and then you could slap down a +4 on top of that.
Yeah.
The next person picks up 8, and you don't pick up 4. That's the real way to play Uno, because it's... It's like the nuclear option, right? It's like it turns a skirmish into a war.
Yes.
And like when you get those moments where somehow everybody has like 3 +2s in their hand and the whole game circles around the table 3 times and the last person has to pick up 24 cards, that's what makes Uno Uno.
Yeah.
And they're not going to capture that in a game show on TV, and certainly not going to capture the real moments, which is when your, you know, great aunt or grandmother or whatever, who seems very nice, loses it during Uno because that's what you do. And you hear them swear for the first
time.
They
call you a cocksucker. They flip the table.
Yeah.
They leave.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You don't see them for 4 months.
Right.
Yeah.
On paper, it seems like a good idea, but they're never going to capture the spirit of Uno, nor should they, frankly, on TV.
Anyway, we'll see how Uno goes. But Whack-A-Mole, will I watch it? 100% yes.
All right, guys, that is it for another episode of Extra Hot Great. We took a trip down Firefly Lane before going around the dial with stops at Mapleworth Murders, Jan, The Investigation, Borgen, and Resident Alien. Tara got a passing grade on her AP Bio Canon project, and we continued the judginess as we crowned winners and losers of the week. Next up, spreading around the holiday cheer on Extra Extra Hot Great and on the next EHG Prime, The Equalizer. Remember,
we're listening.
I am David T. Cole, and on behalf of Tar Ariano,
Mardar,
and Sarah D. Bunting,
I need sun chips.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time, right here on Extra Hot Great.
Are there more white grapes coming, or is this all there is?
Zach? That's all the grapes.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3-bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort-style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, and Emory Education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.